As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is brought to you by bellacatering.com.au. Guys, the folks at Bella Catering are one of the best catering companies in the whole of Australia, and especially in Sydney. But due to the coronavirus restrictions, those lovely folks led by Glenn and Maria are unfortunately struggling. But we can help them, and I want to help them with this show. So if you guys can, and you like delicious things, and you're in Australia, and you're in Sydney, and you're within about a 20K to 30K radius, which is pretty much the entire Sydney basin, if you want delicious food at a great price, and you want it delivered to your house, bellacatering.com.au is where you need to go. Absolutely delicious stuff, family stuff, like, you know, huge, huge get-togethers that we're doing virtually and things like that. You want leftovers, you want that sort of thing, bam, bellacatering.com.au. Glenn is absolutely a deeply questionable individual. However, that should not be held against him. He has a lovely wife, he has a lovely family, and they've got great staff, and they are awesome. Now, onto the show. This is an excerpt from All the President's Men, written by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. Without dwelling on his problems, Bernstein called a telephone company source and asked for a list of Barker's calls. That afternoon, his contact called back and confirmed that the calls listed in the Times had been made. But, he added, he could not get a fuller listing because Barker's phone records had been subpoenaed by the Miami District Attorney. You mean the FBI or the US Attorney's Office, don't you? No. The phone company in Miami said it was the local district attorney, the man said. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me today is a film critic for the LA Times, a former chief critic for Variety, and just someone who, when I read his stuff, particularly his, and when cinema still existed in 2019, he wrote a great piece about all of the best films of 2019. He's a guy with such rich insight that he can incisively frame together a really thoroughly entertaining whodunit like Knives Out and the most incisive class commentary of the year, also thrillingly entertaining and now Best Picture winning Parasite, and entangle them together as his sort of co-winners of the year in such a way that it's just like, man, I'm so thankful for him because he's just, there's no one like him. So it is with my great pleasure now to chat to him on a podcast, finally. He is officially, according to Manola Dargis, her running mate for the president of the film Twitter community in 2020, if the elections are ever held. It's my great pleasure to talk to Justin Chang. Justin, thank you so much for being a part of All the President's Minutes.
Thank you, Blake. Such a pleasure to be here with you. And thank you for that ridiculously kind intro. And Manola and I talked about this. I've already dropped out and endorsed her, you know. Should have done it months ago.
Oh, I'm just saying.
Now everyone is getting in line behind President Dargis.
There's a lot of that going around. There's a lot of that endorsing other candidates.
A lot.
There's a lot of that going around. Oh, man. But yeah, no, she's definitely faithfully our president, and my president. Can I talk to you? I mean, look, it's great to have you on the show, and I'm excited to talk to you. And I know how prepared you are for this, but I just want to go back, take a second and say, films like this, like All the President's Men, like the sort of 70s New Hollywood-esque era, this is because I'm not so familiar with it. How does that stack up in your canon of films? Because when I read your stuff, one thing I think you're very good at is framing, I guess, the socio-political commentary that sometimes is not, or is definitely is definitely there, somewhat can be more implicit or it can be directly explicit, that people sort of, it's simmering under the surface. But I just wonder how formative these films have been for you as an emerging critical voice in your career.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, not having lived through the 70s, I don't know that, you know, I mean, this is such a rich period in American cinema, needless to say. And I think that there's, you know, there are critics who lionize this period as the greatest, you know, in American history. And I'm not even saying they're wrong. I'm not frankly sure if they're right or wrong.
Yes.
I don't even know if I can have that discussion. But, and then there's been, you know, waves of like, well, you know, they're just romanticizing it to some extent. I think it's just really interesting how with All the President's Men in particular, how this movie has become, you know, as much as, or maybe even more than some of its, you know, other, you know, New Hollywood counterparts, such a touchstone in recent years. I mean, I know so many things that you've talked about on your podcast before, like, you know, Zodiac being, you know, a movie that I, you know, it feels like, you know, when I first saw it, it was like, oh, that's the equivalent. And maybe it's a movie that even means a little bit more to me just because it's more, not because it's more recent, but just it even feels like just this apotheosis of what All the President's Men is doing. And then, you know, in more recent years, something like Spotlight, which, you know, I don't think is as great cinema as either of the previous two I just mentioned, but it's just interesting how the kind of, you know, think a bit about, you know, Manny Farber's phrase termite art, or Manny Farber's expression termite art comes to mind.
Yes.
These are movies that burrow deep down into the process. They're great process movies.
Yes.
And something, and so I don't, and so I would almost want to separate All the President's Men from some of the others, because I think it's hardly the only example, but there's something really unique about this as a process movie. And I love process movies. I love movies that risk your, I don't even want to say the word boredom or tedium, you know, because there's nothing, to me, there's nothing boring or tedious about these movies. But I think if you are tired or inattentive, or you're like, why are we watching, you know, why, you know, it's like, I think, you know, somebody once described, you know, Zodiac and movies like this as great, like, filing cabinet cinema, where it just feels, I think it was Nathan Lee, when he reviewed Zodiac in The Village Voice, great, it was a fantastic review, and he said, it's like, it feels like you're being stuck in a filing cabinet for 2 or 2.5 hours, and it's great. And I think it's like, it's something about, you know, where, you know, you have a 2 or 2.5 hour stretch, and so you do have to compress a lot of data and a lot of information, but at the same time, you're not cheating. You're kind of letting the process do the work. You're not trying to connect the dots for the audience. And, you know, William Goldman's screenplay, of course, does this brilliantly. So yeah, it's, I'm really interested in movies, that risk losing a portion of the audience, I would say, you know, and then maybe even overtly flirt with doing that, because it's forcing you to make the leap. It's forcing you to engage more. So that's what's really exciting about this movie in particular for me.
I love when you said, when you're talking about risking tedium, there's, and process movies, there's the filing cabinet movie. I love that. And but there's a film that always leaps out to me. And it was a test that one of my film and media, lecturers did one time, as Abbas Kiarostami, who's an Iranian filmmaker. He made a film called A Taste of Cherry. And there's a scene, multiple scenes in A Taste of Cherry where someone's phone's ringing and the reception where they are is terrible. So they run out of the house, they run down to their car, they run into the car, they turn the car on, the car drives like, you know, 500 meters up the road to a hill where a tree is and answers the phone on the hill. And in the normal cinematic language, or what you would be taught in every single textbook about how to make that scene meaningful, you would have the phone ring. You would maybe, if you wanted to show that they had to go to a lot of trouble, you do some fast, you know, very sexy Edgar Wright, you know, cuts, and you would get him to that hill, right? Like, I think Edgar Wright does those cuts so sexily. He does not, Abbas Kiarostami does not do that. He makes you agonize over every part of that. And we used to, my lecturer used to do it as he'd play it and just make people watch it and infuriate an entire audience. And then there was just it was like a dog whistle for us film obsessives in the actual audience of that lecture going, oh, there is something so amazing about how in touch Kiarostami is with our experience and this agony. And, you know, the Presidents does never goes quite to those lengths. I think Zodiac is much closer than both, but it's those things where if you can affect the same agony in the people who are enduring this process too in the audience, there's such a skill to that. And there's something addictive about it I love. I don't think many people would want to go back and do that again and again with the Kiarostami example, but with this example, I love the toil. I love this toil of this movie.
No, exactly. I love that too. And it's the idea of leaving in those things that in a different filmmaker with a different purpose may have left out. And you're absolutely right that, you know, it's interesting too. You mentioned Kiarostami. I could think, you know, a friend who I took to see a Michael Haneke film once said also the same thing about that. You know, it's something we were much more used to, I think, in certain strains of, you know, European art cinema, realist cinema, where it's like, why are we watching this? Why are we watching this mundane activity? And I love dwelling on this because I think it speaks to the reason, like, why do we watch movies? And for some, it is for an escape, and it is for more, you know, it is for excitement and drama. And for some of us, it's like, it is to experience the mundane realities of life, to recognize those realities in a more heightened kind of way. And it's funny because I know that, you know, the standard way sometimes to talk about something like All the President's Men is that it's such a wonderfully low key movie, and that you mundanity is a word that I will probably overuse in this next hour because it's one of my favorite. I love, you know, I'm just kind of, I love the cinema of the mundane. But it's funny because when I first saw this, and I guess I'll might as well go to that, it's like I saw this in college as a journalism student. Mm-hmm. I may have said before then, I can't remember the first time I saw it, but it was really weird because I was one of those people who actually saw it in tandem with reading the book, because it was assigned reading in like my journalism law class and history of journalism classes. So, you know, it's interesting when you're receiving it from that angle. You know, it's like, you know, Woodward and Bernstein, this, you know, the most lionized duo in American journalism. And, you know, just watching it then, I was struck by, oh yeah, the rhythms of this movie, the visual language of this movie is much more. And I think I was watching it on some crappy VHS copy that I can't remember, you know, and, you know, it didn't.
So
you know,
many of us have been in a overlit library on a shitty VHS watching classic movies.
Absolutely. Oh my God. I was watching like Godard and Wong Kar-wai movies in my library. It's like horrible. Like,
I reckon, you know, if I'd had Letterboxd back then, shit, it would have looked impressive. Like the classics that I absolutely just mowed through in that shitty library on terrible TVs with interruptions and whatever. But yeah, like some, you know, that's the only way that you could do it. That's the only way you could do these things.
It really was. And so it was kind of a revelation, I think, even just to rewatch it. And I've been kind of rewatching it just over and over, just individual scenes here and there in the past 2 weeks or so. And on my, you know, decent, reasonably sized TV screen, streaming it, and it looks great. I mean, it's still nowhere near. I've never seen this movie on the big screen, and I feel like that's a huge loss. And the minute, you know, once we are able to go to theaters again. I was so lucky.
In Oz, they do classics at sort of one of our big cinema chains called Event Cinemas in Sydney. And I saw two films in like 2 weeks with a couple of my buddies, Garth Franklin and Stu Coote, who've both been on the show and big parts of my other show, One Heat Minute. And so we were making a rhythm, like 1 week was Presidents and Stu and I had both seen it. Garth had never seen it or maybe had only seen bits and pieces of it. And we saw it on the big screen. It was in a digital print. It looked amazing. To be with an audience was incredible, but it wasn't on 35 mil. And I was just like, it's one of those things where you're like, oh man, if I was at a New Bev or like in Sydney, the equivalent is like the Hayden Orpheum. It's like, if someone had a 35 mil print of this, I feel like it'd leap off the screen a different way. And the other tragedy, which I'll just say again, because it was just one of my last, you know, experiences, is there was The Searchers. They had a digital print of The Searchers, but it wasn't in the correct aspect ratio, Justin. It wasn't in VistaVision. And it was just like, it was terrible. You can't do that. But I agree with you. There's something about, it looks tremendous. And the example that I want to touch on with you is that, and this is a real thing that I think about now with Spotlight, is there's definitely like a bunch of criticism about that movie around lacking style. And I really feel like if the voice of Tom McCarthy as the director and filmmaker in that movie is anything, it is Liev Schreiber. Like, Liev Schreiber's character is there, and at the end, they've got the story. He's got the story, and he's circling red with a red pen. Bless the red pen, right? Ben Bradley in this film. He's circling the adjectives, and he's like, get the adjectives out of this story. And I feel like that's Tom McCarthy's whole style. So if the intent is, get the adjectives out of this story, tell it as ugly and as raw as possible, because the emotion and the time and the regret and all those things are just going to be on the canvases of my performers' faces. And God, it's just like, no one's wearing makeup. Everyone has every line in their face. Like, you know, way. Like, I think of Roger from Mad Men in it. I always forget the actor's name, but I'm like, he's Roger from Mad Men forever.
John Slattery. Absolutely. Yeah.
Slattery's face is like, in this movie, he's never looked so haggard, and you're like, wow, like, and as Roger, he's a stud. Like, he's just, his hair's always perfect, his suit's amazing. And so, yeah, I think that that's one thing about this film, is while it is that cinema of the mundanity, and in those newsrooms it's, you're grinding through, the style is so beautifully interwoven in the language in a way that is, I think, is incomparable to something like, you know, you can't compare it to Spotlight, because Spotlight's doing something completely different. Right.
It is something different, and oh my God, Liev Schreiber in that movie. We won't talk about Spotlight too much, but that's my favorite performance. And I think it was one of my, I love that performance so much. And it just shows you how you can be riveting.
Completely underrated. It's like his best performance in his whole career.
It's truly the best thing I've seen him do. And he is like, his face is just like made of just immovable granite in that movie. And yet, so expressive too. And I love that we're talking about this, because it's like, even within, you know, this if you talk about just newsroom cinema, I guess you look at David Fincher, you look at Tom McCarthy, and you look at Alan Pakula, it's like there's such a gradient even there. There's such a diversity of style even there. And I would say, you know, Fincher is the one who is maybe the most overtly kind of virtuosic in the way he places the camera and the colors of the news and everything. And then Pakula is somewhere in between, you know, but, you know, it was, you know, when I see it again someday, I'm sure it'll be a revelation. But it's funny, even seeing it now for the first time in some years, you know, it's a movie I go back to every so often, but it's funny how what might have seemed slow or taxing, you know, the first time, I don't even know if it's me, I don't think I found it really difficult or anything the first time I saw it, but it just, now it's like, oh my God, this thing moves. Oh, I mean, it's like, and you almost want, perversely, the perverse side of me that would love to see, you know, it's funny because it's cinema. It's like, it's the compactness is part of the experience. I mean, the compression and the economy of the storytelling is part of the experience, but you almost want, like, you know, the 5-hour experience. You want to see them, go for the back breaks, go for the coffee break, you know, what, you know, it's like, you would find, and I'm sure, you know, find, and breaks, I'm sure that would be ripped.
A few more story takes. You want to see Sally Aitken go out to score that information. You know, there's so many of those little bits that you're like, see the bookkeeper coming home. You know, I totally agree. There's that hint that you just want something else.
Well, I would say too, here is my old pet peeve about this genre of journalism, print journalism movies in particular, as great as these movies are, as much as I love All the Presidents Men, is I would love for us to actually read the stories like on screen somehow, like maybe one of them. I mean, it's always, you know, and it's like, I know you get it. It's like, that would be just truly perverse. You know, what were you reading? The reading column inch by column inch on the screen, that'd be ridiculous, you know. But, you know, here, you know, in most, the convention is usually you get a montage of headlines, or in All the President's Men, you get the glimpses of the front pages, and, you know, you
as they're being delivered to the White House, right?
Yeah. Delivered to the White House. And that's great. And that's, and I get it. It's like, yes, that's all you need. But it's like, oh, that's, you know, and even I would almost love to go more obsessive and like, what is, you know, close up, what is he actually circling on the page? You know? Yeah. And I realize I'm probably speaking only to you and myself, and I don't know who else.
Anyone like listening to this show, anyone who's listening is feeling the same.
We're absolutely true. No, I'm not speaking to the void. I'm sure there are people who, you know, the listener,
you know,
who would find that.
You know, who's an interesting case study with that though is, David Yates, who directed the Harry Potter films, directed State of Play, which was the adaptation.
Really, yeah.
And which is a very, you know, a very good film. And one of the rare examples where you bridge the gap between what we'd call like All the Presidents and Zodiac at classical journalism, and later what Tom McCarthy's doing with Spotlight, bridging sort of 21st century journalism and 20th century journalism together. And it's funny that Yates, for a guy who like clearly is into the news and into the cycle, you know, and he does it in State of Play and loves being in that journalism, it's actually in the Harry Potter movies that he uses that device more overtly than any other film. Like, there's a story from Rita Skeeter, and you read Rita Skeeter's story. Like, when you were saying that, I'm like, what other movie does that? I'm like, it's fucking Harry Potter. Like, it's the only one. And I always thought that is such a great technique, because it's a way, it's that little bit longer than just a pure headline. It's kind of this intermingling montage. There's the moving pictures. It becomes a way, a bridging graphic to take you, as opposed to an establishing shot. And he's just like, I'm going to just go hard in the paint on, this is my version of an establishing shot for this movie. And I think it's in the fifth one, Order of the Phoenix, which is his first. And I always thought that device was so terrific, because it helped him move. It helped him get from point A to point B. It helped him to exposition dump and keep the momentum up in what was already a long movie. And yeah, I don't think I've seen it anywhere else. I didn't think we'd get there. Yeah. I didn't know we'd
arrive. I love that we're talking about Harry Potter. No, I am always, I mean, people are like, too good to talk about Harry Potter. I don't mind, you know, and it's just, but no, I mean, that is also that particular story in the cycle too is very much about, you know, political deceit and about skullduggery. And, you know, in that case, journalism is a very negative entity, you know, because Rita Skeeter is a total hack, a Voldemort kind of hack or something. I'm butchering the fantasy. People are going to get mad at me, but you know, exactly right. I mean, it's, and I love that the idea of bringing that kind of rigor even to a fantasy world. You know, we could use some more of that.
From a fantasy world to a fantasy heartthrob, we arrive at our scene. Robert Redford in a bathrobe, a wonderful little minute. And again, in the last few that I've recorded, and people get sick of me saying this, but sometimes when scenes unfold, they're just perfect. They just feel like they were intended to be 60 seconds. So Justin and I are going to watch this scene, the reveal of How to Meet Deep Throat and the beginnings of the scene as we see Woodward for the first time go to meet Hal Holbrook's Deep Throat. And we hear some beautiful David Shire score and some Washington Slick Streets. And we're going to watch together. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk all about it.
Wall Street prices took a pounding yesterday, with the Dow Jones closing down 6.75 points in moderate trading. And the dollar took a beating on the European money market, dropping to its floor market level under heavy selling pressure. In sports in Muirfield, Scotland, Lee Trevino and Tony Jacklin share the halfway lead in the British Open Golf Tournament. Both at 1.41. Johnny Miller is back.
Thank you.
What a cracker of a scene. I love that scene.
It's so great. And it's funny because you told me it was this minute. I was kind of relieved that, oh, it's this minute, not the next one. The next one is great too, but it's way, you know, it's it doesn't have as much incident.
There's not as much incident. It is in the minutia. Like you're in a cab, you're changing cabs, you're walking. There's the lead up to this scene. Cause you know what, hopefully people are going to enjoy about the show is like when you're stitching this whole scene together, it's kind of impossible not to talk about the surrounding minutes. But this particular sequence is once the flag goes out, it's so hard to imagine going, what is he doing? Like, oh, is this the lengths that Deep Throat is making him go to? Like, who is this guy? And so it's nice to just see this. I love this unfolding moment. It really sets the tone of like, again, it's almost like that shot in the 30th minute and the 31st minute of the Library of Congress. It's pulling out.
Yeah.
We're being dwarfed. We don't know what this big system is, but it's there.
You're getting, there's a sense in which watching the scene, you know, the paranoia has sort of been simmering for a while, but suddenly this real palpable element of danger enters the picture and part of that is what I think this scene does so well is I think it speaks actually to a little bit of the difference between the movie and the book, where, you know, it's the withholding of information because you don't know who this guy is. You haven't heard the words Deep Throat yet, of course, you know, Deep, whom we now know, of course, since 2005 to have been Mark Felt. And it's funny because after I watched the scene and I say, I went back to the book and I reread this part and the way the book lays it out is so much more, you know, obviously kind of cut and dry, giving it's the book is trying to give you that information and the movie plays it for suspense. And, you know, even just the details, the minutiae of the system that they work out, you know, in terms of with the red flag and the circling of the page 20 in the New York Times, it's like, it's almost, you get the sense it's like, is Deep Throat, like, does he have this apartment bugged and you don't know who he is? You don't know their relationship. There's a lot of like variables that have not been introduced. And I think that the way, and it tells you, I love this scene too, because of course, obviously this is very standalone about Bob Woodward, this whole scene. And you're getting a sense of who he is too, and his history, because up to this point, you know, he's had this, you know, this somewhat catchy, but gradually finding its way back and forth with Carl Bernstein. And, you know, he is sort of the rookie of the two. Yes. He has only been with the paper for 9 months. This, you know, and has something to prove, is sort of seen as this, you know, preppy, not very serious, you know, like can he cut it is the thing.
Yes.
And, you know, and the story has stalled and I think it's interesting too. And if really just in terms of the setup of this whole moment, it shows you something about, you know, Bernstein's response and attitude is to sort of, you know, kind of go to the mat and fight with Ben Bradley about it. No, it's a really important story. And then Bob Woodward's attitude is, no, we don't have it. He said, we don't have it. Let's find another way. And I think it just tells you, it's just a really nice, you know, shows you the difference in their characters and their temperaments, obviously, you know, prove very complimentary. But then Woodward goes and he, you know, he makes this phone call and then, you know, and seems to have gotten shut down. But then this happens. And it's just... And so it's literally where the story is suddenly, it almost feels like the story is pursuing him all of a sudden. And I just love, I don't know where I have so many, I don't even know where to start with, but why don't we, I guess from the beginning,
let's start with one thing. I just wanted to jump right onto the coattails of what you were saying is what we know about Woodward so far, where he's been really virtuosic compared to Bernstein's ability to wrangle a story and just show that it is it's in his ability to extract information out of people. And so there's that great scene in the courtroom where he's extracting so much more information that no one wants to be giving him. I don't know, talk to him. And he's having a conversation 5 minutes after with a person who's already said, I don't want to talk to you. And so that is his real wonderful skill. And so then for a lull in this movie, which again, when you watch it in real time, you blink and you're here. You know, things are all happening so fast. But when you're here, you're like, oh, this is a guy who's really good at getting information out of people. Yeah. And so it's in this moment where the movie starts to rest on his shoulders that, like, oh my God, he's got a source that can see a flag on his balcony. Like, mm-hmm. exactly like you said, he's got a source who's able to communicate with him by putting a note in his paper between the time at, like, whatever 4 a.m. that the New York Times is delivered. And who is that contact? Where are they? From another paper? And it gets you to ask all those questions. But I think that's that one thing that, unlike Bernstein's, you know, tenacity and his greenness are their probably weaknesses, it's Carl's being able to glance at a news article and go, where is the actual story here and how do I layer it? It's his ability to talk to people in this movie. And that's like echoed through his entire career, right? So I love that in this scene. It's like, oh, now the door's opened up, but we don't even know what door this is. We don't even know where it's going to.
We don't know. And it's very true. And even just with the realization that Woodward had a source ranked, who's positioned in one of the highest levels of the federal government. As, yes. And again, we don't know that watching this, which adds to the sense of danger. I was just so taken with just the detail, because, you know, you think about this, you know, how true to the, you know, and it can be very boring sometimes to talk about, did it really happen or not? Although with the movie, you know, with one of the great journalism movies of all time, you know, that question becomes a lot more interesting. And so it was just so fascinating to me, the details of the system that they worked out and how did they know? And I think that, you know, this is again where there is an economy, a narrative economy in this movie that leaves out the scenes where they were probably working it out. It just seems like all of a sudden, like, you know, Deep Throat just knows the layout of his apartment, knows the delivery schedule for his New York Times. I have to say too, and, you know, because it starts kind of with the New York Times, by the way, another pet peeve of mine with journalism movies is newspaper front pages that look nothing like the actual front page. I mean, I know it's probably easier in 1976 to duplicate a 1972 front page, but I've seen, you know, it's just like this, you know, newspaper front page that looks a little more like my high school newspaper than it does. Like, I'm kind of a font enthusiast. I love typefaces. I love kerning and letting and all that.
You're allowed to have that. That is a totally job appropriate pet peeve. My greatest pet peeve in multi-million dollar movies is really terribly photoshopped family pictures. Like, if I'm in the middle of a rigorous, like, it could be a whodunit, a thriller, like, it's got me. If I see a dumb, like, photoshopped face, I'm like, how did this get through?
How did they not have somebody in place to catch that?
Send it to the internet. Like, in 2 seconds on Twitter, someone will have one better for you. Like, just stop. Yeah, nothing infuriates me more. So yeah, we'll get back to our pet peeves later.
No. But no, I think that, to me, for the significance of the New York Times is really, you know, and this is something that the rivalry between the Times and the Post is very important in this movie, and also in the Post, Steven Spielberg's, you know, movie prequel to All the President's Men, basically. And I just love that, you know, the note from Deep Throat to Woodward is being passed, like, under, you know, within the fold of the New York Times. I mean, just that this is the paper, you know, this is another, not an adversary, but this is who they're competing with. This is the paper of record that the Post is trying to, you know, and will eventually not only, you know, keep up with, but will actually beat to the story. And so there's something just kind of very fitting about that.
It's so omnipresent in his reality that I'm not going to bother putting it in the Post for that day. It's going in the Times because I know you're reading it. I know that you're going to
be reading it. Know you have a delivery. And I went down kind of a rabbit hole reading this, and where it's just like, you know, it kind of had something to do with, you know, how accurate is what we're seeing, because apparently, you know, Woodward was very particular about his New York Times every day. And you see in the scene too, this stack of newspapers, you know, so he reads them religiously, doesn't throw them away. They're just sitting there in a pile. And, you know, he was very particular. And then, but some people were saying that, oh, you know, it wasn't delivered to his door. And he had, so how could he throw on the note? And then I think Woodward himself said, well, no, they were actually, it was labeled to him. So he insisted on his own labeled copy and all of this. So kind of people trying to debunk, did this, you know, how, you know, the accuracy of certain of these details. But I just love that, you know, this reverence that everyone has for the New York Times as, you know, as the greatest newspaper, even as they are trying to undermine it. It's a very nice touch. And, you know, yeah, so it's, and also you know, it's the New York Times. It's also the red flag. I mean,
it doesn't look
a literal good. Red. It doesn't look no. But,
it's a literal red flag.
How more on the nose could that be? And yet, by all accounts, it seems that this was something where I believe Woodward was apparently out and found this red cloth just lying somewhere, and he brought it back with him and put it, and it was a friend like put it in the flower pot. And so it's like, and again, yeah. So how did Deep Throat know this? Had he been there? Presumably, I don't know. And again, the movie is not telling you any of this, but the fact that they have this elaborately worked out system. And again, you know, the color red, you know, which is a color that recurs throughout this movie, in the newsroom,
yes,
and in other places. And it just pops up. And as this sort of, you know, this harbinger of danger, you know, and literally that is like, you know, whether it's like here he is like, you know, putting out his, you know, his bat signal or his, you know, his red.
can I just say it's so funny when you get to a moment. I've been watching this scene for so long, and I'm like, and you just go, it's a literal red flag, Blake. And I'm just like, oh my God, I have never articulated, actually said the words. It is a red flag. Yeah, of course. Of course it's a red flag. Of course it's a red flag. Couldn't be anything else, Justin.
I mean, it took me like, I think, a fifth viewing to realize just how on the nose it was. It's one of those things where, you know, where you think maybe they would have changed it to make it seem more realistic.
But like, no, the truth is stranger. But I love that it is so on the nose, but it's also the way that it's, and you can attest to this as a guy who, you know, scrutinizes so many films and sees so many films. It's like the economy of the, if you now in this moment, where other moments we want to get lost and dive into the minutiae, the fact that they go, the system, it works, and we're going to gloss over it, makes it effortless. And it's like, we're not going to focus on that. We'd rather focus on what it takes for him to hit the, to pound the pavement, to have a system to do that. We're not going to talk about how it's worked out. It actually makes it more, it underscores the mystery of it and the system that they've got to circumvent way more if you just, it happens. Like, these guys have to do things like this, and this is just Redford's earnestness and sincerity and sort of, you know, all American charm. He's just kind of like, oh, this is strange, and puts the red flag out there and jumps in a cab, and he's just like, I guess I better do this. This is how I got to do it.
He's so businesslike about it. And to what you were saying about, you know, you could make an entire movie that consisted just with his interactions with Deep Throat. This is where so much of the source of the intrigue lies. And this is a movie, Lubbock's movie, is that it is explaining a lot to you. I mean, in some ways it's an explanatory kind of movie. At the same time, it's intent on preserving some of the mystery of Watergate and some of the mystery that would be debunked, you know, or not debunked, but would be dispelled when, you know, Felt came forward and revealed his true identity. But here it's like, this is a movie that respects its mystery and knows that that is sort of one of the enduring sources of the power of this story. And, you know, you just hit with so many questions. But yeah, the fact that Woodward just does not question it, he just, and it's funny too, this is a moment that this scene comes almost like as a bit of an invasion, or this moment. It's an invasion of his privacy. A certain, I mean, you know, we're watching him in this private moment, so the camera's mere presence is that as well. But here he is in his bathrobe, and you and Blake, you and I were talking about earlier, just like, you know, it's like no one has ever looked better with sopping wet hair in a bathrobe. It's so funny to me. I think this movie is built on a lot of paradoxes, because in some ways it is, you know, these actors, you know, Hoffman and Redford are, you know, sort of deglamorizing themselves, you know, dowdying themselves up to play these journalists. But at the same time, you know, is the movie itself, you know,
there's only so much they can do. They're glamorizing. It's an oxymoronic pursuit. Like, it's like they are there to lionize them. And their mere presence makes this film viable, right? Like, it's like, that's the other practical and pragmatic thing you have to do is what we, absolutely, when you and I encountered it, and by the sounds of things, it was around the same time of our lives. We sort of encountered it at that level. And for me, it was university level, yours was college. When you encounter this movie for the first time, we're encountering it in this protracted way. Like, it's completely away from when the film is actually made. And so what you have to go back and go is, God, that maintenance of that mystery and the withholding of facts there is what is keeping people interested who have literally seen nothing but this story in their newspapers for 2 years, which is something that is unconscionable to you and I. Like, it just doesn't absolutely even compute.
It's true. I mean, the economy of the storytelling is in part of, exactly as you say, it's a response to the immediacy of the movie, how yes quickly it followed the events that it portrays.
Which and is so
it's
also like, crazy. Which is crazy.
Completely crazy. And, you know, I oh my God, it's like, it's just funny. It reminds me even of, you know, I mean, different case, of course, but, you know, when people were asking if it was 5 years after 9/11, it was too soon to start making that movie. And I understand, yes, because that was a different kind of tragedy and trauma, you know, and, you know, this, when you're dealing with mass death, but, you know, I totally get that. But there's something really bracing about, and I know that a movie like All the President's Men is more of the exception than the rule, but this, you know, the much vaunted risk taking of the 70s, the, yes, just the Noble Bard, the sense of creative risk, which is what we so cherish about that decade, and the fact that they felt that, oh, this is going to be a really compelling movie, that the public is actually going to want to relive this, that there will be something, you know, whether they learn anything new, there'll be something, I think they would, but there's something really cathartic about going back to that. And here, you know, watching it and playing, you know, and I think about this a lot, because whenever I think about Watergate, when I think about, you know, events that I didn't live through and just, you know, but they're still so much a part of the consciousness of people who are older than I am, I feel like this almost sense of like yearning almost, like, oh God, I wish I could have lived through that. And so a movie like, you know, reading the book, reading the coverage, watching this movie is the closest we can get to that.
It's so crazy because it's like, yeah, that whole Vietnam era, it's like, man, if only we lived during Vietnam. And it's like so dumb. It's the stupidest.
It's so dumb. I'm like, God, this stuff, like, not nostalgic. I mean, there's things with Watergate, there are things to be genuinely inspired by. And
yes,
think about, you know, if we, you know, everyone is, of course, you know, extrapolating that from that onto our present, you know, where just, you know, yesterday when Trump was saying, you know, the president has total authority, it's like, okay, wow. It's like, it's enough to make, you know, and of course, you know, Charles Ferguson's documentary on Watergate, it's like, it is enough to make you nostalgic for that national historical, yes, trauma. At least that was better than
at least for all of Nixon's obsessive flaws and bad things, at least he had the dignity to retire. At least it's so funny is that the Trump presidency is truly the greatest savior for the Nixon legacy. Like, it is literally everyone's reflecting and going, you know what? He was fine.
He
wasn't that bad. I mean, look, we should have kept him in. Watergate, Schmortergate, you know? It's one of those crazy things. But no, I agree. There's a, when we look at it must happen with cinephiles, like I think about exactly what you said, like the creative, there's like those creative instigators, these huge tumultuous political moments that are happening, and then all this creative risk that's happening at the same time. And you go, man, you know, I wish I would be in a cinema to have seen Taxi Driver when it came out, or I wish I was there. And I think this is another really hugely new Hollywood movie, but doesn't get the credit for being a new Hollywood movie. At least the first half is Jaws. Like, the first half of Jaws, yeah, is as new Hollywood as it gets. It is about, and you know, all the memes have been telling you, it is about a mayor who would rather people die in his town,
mm-hmm,
than close a fucking beach. And it's, yep, just like, that's as new Hollywood, mm-hmm, as it gets. And it then just so happens, and this is the skill of Spielberg, it then absolutely transforms into a monster, yep, movie. But all of that, I think what actually frames the movie perfectly and keeps us interested and keeps the fire in our belly, it's the context of that. It is that you would be willing for money, for the, mm-hmm, economy, to sacrifice people's lives, and it's fine. And everyone is in complete agreement about it. But there is a tipping point where morality does set in.
And that first half, of course, describes a situation that is playing out in cities and communities all over the world.
All over the
and
world.
And in the U.S. And prescient, to say the least. I mean, it's like, I mean,
if we can do one thing in this podcast, it's to underscore how stupid we both feel for wanting to be back in the '70s for this time. But it's like it just might be an indictment of our current situation in the 2020. That God, wouldn't it be nicer if we could just be outside and there were wars going on and there was
so
political
nice.
Intrigue?
So much better, right? Oh my God! But it's truly, and I mean it's telling how, you know, the movie, which completely holds up now and feels as fresh as it did then.
Yes.
You know, what seemed like a purely practical, pragmatic, economical storytelling decision back then, now plays like a very just effective suspense device. And, you know, you're completely, you know, if you're coming to this movie, you know, however many 40, 50 years after the events that it portrays, you know, it still just works like gangbusters. So, and you know, just in the scene too, going back, it's like the sense of like, I think it's a great scene about the workaholism of journalism.
Yes.
You know, this is, you know, you're in this, I think the second time we've seen Woodward's apartment. The first time is when he gets called out to the Watergate burglary story to begin with. And you know, you see, it's like, it's a very dark, low lit apartment and, in complete stark contrast to the fluorescent brightness of the newsroom.
Yes.
And just the details, you know, the bathroom and everything. And you see, it's interesting. A detail that stuck out to me on like my third or fourth time, it's like, he's wearing this wristwatch already, you know, and he's fresh from the shower. And I mean, you imagine he just must have put that, it's like in this little, and I can't recall if, you know, but I mean, if he's wearing it fresh out of the shower, it's like he wears it all the time. You know,
yes.
He must wear it. It's like always on the clock, and
always on always on the clock and ready to go, whether you're asleep,
you know,
whether you're out of the shower. Like he's just it's an odd thing to always think of yourself on the clock, but he clearly does. Like that's you're so right about the reflex. It must be the first thing he does when he gets out of the shower is dry his hand and put his wristwatch back on.
Put his wristwatch on. And it's interesting just looking at his clothing, because Woodward and Redford, they're interchangeable to me in the movie. It's like, and I can substitute one for the other. He's such a great actor, and he's so good in this. He does not say a word in this entire scene, and yet you, I don't want to say it's like you know everything that's going on in his head, but you follow his thought processes, you follow his thought processes, even his questions, without him saying a word, you know. In that shot of the balcony from the outside, which is itself kind of this chilling shot where the you know, this apartment, I think, was on the sixth floor of where he lived back then. And, you know, but you don't know where he, you know, you don't see the top of the building. You don't see the bottom.
Yeah.
All you see are these identical rooms across the way, adjacent. It's like, is he being watched from one of those? He could be anywhere, right?
Anywhere.
Deep Throat could be anywhere. Apparently now we know he was watching from below and in the courtyard or the alleyway or wherever it was. But in that shot, when Woodward comes out, it's like, oh, he's changed his clothes. He's wearing now, you know, this, you know, pressed shirt and with the sleeves rolled up, and he's wearing trousers. And so it's like, okay, it's just very, you know, and then in the next shot, of course, when he is, you know, on his way in the cab, you know, he's, you know, fully dressed and everything. So you even just, this is the way you get a little progression. Just, I think just, you know, the clothing tells you so much in this movie, and it's just like, it's showing you just the progress of a work day, you know, and the work day for him begins before he's even had the chance to put on a damn shirt, you know?
And we talked about him being good looking, but I think as well, you are so right. He's such a damn good actor at knowing what his face can do as a canvas. He doesn't have to say a word. I love all the choices in this movie from Pacula and his performers when they withhold, when they don't say something, or in a huge pregnant pause between the line delivery, because in this moment he's like, he doesn't look sure about what's going on. And that's what's great. When he plants the flag, he's not sure. We're not sure. We're directionless as to where he is. When he's in the cab, he's looking and it's inquisitive and it's confused and it's like, I don't know why I'm now going to the lengths, but all of that is just playing out. It's like you can almost feel how clinically the direction writing is there. Just like, don't have him saying anything, but he's curious. He's on the way. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know what he's doing. And like that being him being so in touch with that mindset in that moment, I just love mm-hmm. it, because it's like they're the scenes that you can just watch over and over again, because nothing ever ages with emotion. Like nothing ever ages with his emotion.
Absolutely. I think it's instructive to think, I hadn't thought about this before, but just what would the Dustin Hoffman, Carl Bernstein version of this.
Oh my God.
Like, it's like, maybe, you know, would he be talking to himself? Just, blah, 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 you know, I don't know. It's just like, it's just a completely different kind of scene, right?
He would be smoking, like
obsessively.
He'd be doing those where you're lighting the new cigarette with the one you've just finished moments. Like that would be the Bernstein energy in there. Like he'd be looking everywhere. He might be talking to the cab driver. Like the scene would play so differently if it was him. It's actually the stillness of Redford and Woodward in this scene. Like the stillness is like part of it, because you have to like, that's that, as you said, just the leaning in, you're getting closer. Nothing's being said. Everything's about gesture. Everything's about your observations of that second. And each passing moment, like what the hell is going on? Where are we going? Where's he going? Is he going to this big event? Is this where this guy is? And I think for a brief second we forget, it's like when he gets out of the cab at this event, you're like, oh, you know, the traditional what is now kind of a rote thing is like, oh, you go to a big public place and there's, you know, in espionage films you stand there, and then in this crowded room someone stands directly behind you, they don't look at you, and you're having a conversation with them and you're not looking at each other, but you're in the same room, and it's like one of those things. But even the more, you know, I suppose hallowed turf of an underground car park is about to come up in what follows, but the Bernstein version of this would be hilarious.
It would be hilarious, and yet I think what binds the two is that you come away, it's the twinship actually, as well as the contrast between their characters, is that, you know, you think about Bernstein's tenacity and his fearlessness and his confrontational quality. And as you, I think, alluded to at the beginning, it's like you realize that Woodward, it just doesn't, you know, it's a more quiet and reserved guy, but also has just as much courage and just as much tenacity in his own way. He is just so unflappable about it.
Yes.
And just, I mean, this just goes even just to the different personas or personae rather of Hoffman and Redford. It's like, you know, it's not like they of course are not these characters, but if you think about the qualities that they just embody, there is always often this stillness about Redford, this sort of unflappability and just this cool, right? He just plays it so cool, and he knows. He doesn't make a big deal about it. He knows that he knows also who this guy is. He knows things that we do not. So I think he, you know, suspects that, yes, he will, you know, emerge from this with his, you know, he's not in physical danger, unless from people who are pursuing him, of course. But, you know, he knows the risk and he's willing to take it. And he just goes about it in a way that is just very methodical, very, okay, here I go. And can we go to the, when he gets in the cab, that part, can we talk about that? Just, you know, I love, you know, just the upsurge of the music, that beautiful music, with its sort of the ominous strains of the music. And then he's in the cab and he's sort of just looking ahead, you know, again, not saying anything. And the White House comes into view behind him for a fraction of a second. For a fraction of a second. And it's like glowing, like, you know, looks almost like radioactive, which of course is, I imagine, how it looks at night. But it's like, it's also foreshadowing, because I can't remember if this is the first time we've seen it in the movie or not, but we will definitely see it again as, you know, as the papers are delivered. And I just think it's really this, as this visual motif in the movie, where we first see it from the outside, and this is like, and we don't, you know, viewers in
right now, we're just skating around it. We haven't confronted. There aren't any stories that are penetrating. There aren't the amazing scene where the person starts to take photographs of Woodward, of Bernstein with his FBI counterpart out the front. You know, we haven't gotten close. This is just this beautiful little beacon in the background, and they've done it so cleverly with whole stack of government buildings and monuments all the way up to this point is just hints of a system that is just there. It is there as this big monolithic thing that is just around in this city.
It's there, and you know, you could blink and miss it. Yes. And he doesn't really even seem to notice it. I mean, I don't think he, I mean, undoubtedly driven past it any number of times. It's no big deal. And at this is the point where they know it's, you know, this question of just how far up the chain of command does this go? Does it reach the Oval Office? And, you know, of course we know that it does, but for him, it's just this, it's this, you know, this beautifully moody dissolve from before to here. And it's like, here's the impregnable fortress of the White House looming in the darkness. And it's like, this is their goal. This is the end game. This is where, you know, this is the, you know, where it will, this story is ultimately going to take them. And I love how later throughout the movie, they are not there when the papers are delivered, when the delivery guy drives through the gate and, you know, the security check and everything. But every, you know, the movie is like bringing us closer and closer and finally like kind of penetrating that border in subsequent scenes. So it's just beautifully laying out the groundwork, you know, visually, structurally for what is going on, you know, in the movie.
Well, I think that is the perfect place to end this beautiful conversation, which is that we're going to keep going, and this next steps into this underground car park are going to continue to get us closer to penetrating those White House lawns. Yeah. I have been having a great time talking to you, Mr. Justin Chang. This has been a thrill. Thank you so much for being a part of the show. And
thank you, Blake.
And I have to say, what you have done is you've also done the same thing that the great Manola Dargis did, which is that you mentioned Zodiac so effusively once again that now you have to know that in July we start a 12-episode miniseries called Zodiac Chronicle, and I'm going to have you back for that. Like, we're going to have to talk about Zodiac. So we'll have to stay in touch. That.
I am so glad. And can I just say to Blake, I admire... Of all the things I admire about you, you know, just your extreme wealth of knowledge, your fantastic podcast, just the punny names that you come up for these series. I love all the presents. I love Increment Vice. I can't. Zodiac Chronicle, I know it's a tougher one, but it works too.
Yeah.
It's commitment to the bit.
Very recently, Katie Walsh and I were talking for the longest time about how to penetrate Miami Vice as a topic, and as soon as we came up with Miami Nice, it was just like, oh my, it's right there. It's been right there this whole time. We were too close to it. We're too close to it, Justin. It is
made need a fresh set of ears.
Just fresh set of ears. I credit that all to my best friend Maria Lewis. She actually hates Miami Vice, but she's like, of course it's Miami Nice. What are you even doing? I'm like, okay, fine. You're the best selling author. What do I know? Justin, you're the best. Thank you so much. This has been such a treat. And I look forward to talking to you again soon.
My pleasure. Like, thank you so much for having me. It's been real.
That was the incredible Justin Chang. You can find Justin at the LA Times and on NPR's Fresh Air. And you can find him on Twitter at Justin C. Chang. And you find all of his stuff there. This has been another episode of All the President's Minutes. And we just want to thank you so much for listening and following along the show. If you want to help us out, we would love if you could share, subscribe, rate, review the show. It helps other people discover it. And we have an amazing array of shows coming to One Heat Minute Productions feed or already happening. So right now, we are past the hour mark with Travis Woods' Increment Vice. Next week, Ryan Johnson, director of Brick, The Last Jedi. It is going to be a banger. So you definitely need to subscribe and share that one. Josie and the Podcats, our limited series on the 2001 Josie and the Pussycats with host Maria Lewis, is almost at the end this week. If you're listening to this episode, in just a day's time, you're going to be able to hear the finale episode with one more bonus episode to go after that. A new show will be popping up to replace Josie in our feed on a weekly basis. That is going to be Miami Nice, where Katie Walsh and I settle in with a couple of mojitos and share all the things we love about Michael Mann's 2006 film, Miami Vice. We'll be talking characters, we'll be talking quotes, we'll be talking needle drops, we'll be talking mojitos. And of course, in just a couple of months' time, we have our new series, a limited one at that, but nonetheless extensive, Zodiac Chronicles. So One Heat Minute Productions is where you need to go. Our back catalogue of amazing shows, Contingent, we went through and spent basically a month talking to people online about the COVID-19 crisis. Last 12 minutes of the Mohicans, One Heat Minute, our flagship show. Please subscribe, rate, share, review. We'd love if you could do that. And we appreciate you. And thank you so much for listening.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.